We're talking to our guest all the way on the other side of the world. His name is Bill Chalker. He's an industrial chemist by trade, but is better known as perhaps the preeminent UFO researcher in Australia, written extensively on the subject. He's written two excellent books, one called Hair of the Alien, the other called The Oz Files, and he joins us now from way down there. Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Good. How are you, George?
I should explain to our audience, I had a chance to meet you 2 years ago. I was invited to come down to Sydney, and you hauled me around for a day and showed me the sights, and I worry that you have some photos of me with marsupials in compromising positions.
Yeah, just between you and me, I think.
I'm glad to hear that. Let's start with China, and I know we'll get to the Australian UFO scene in a bit, but there's all these stories coming out of China, millions see UFO motherships and videos taken and scientists studying it. Give us a sense of how you've had entry to the Chinese UFO situation, and then describe the general parameters.
Right. I guess in general terms, in China at the moment, there does seem to be a bit of a UFO flap going. It's always very difficult to get the dimensions of what's going on, you know, but clearly Chinese media is really grappling with it and getting a lot of reports through all sorts of diverse channels, et cetera. And a lot of that you can pick up via the internet, et cetera. And sometimes when you try and do a translation via Google Translate, a lot of things are lost in translation. And that's been, I think, a part of the big impact on some of the stories that are leaking out to the West. For example, the latest business with regard to the UFO eclipse videos, that got picked up widely by English newspapers, and that certainly got lost in translation. But there is an element of some very interesting stories there that I can go into detail. But the general mix is that something certainly is going on in China at the moment, and it does seem to have a UFO wave nature to it, but it's part of a long, rich history of UFO-related stories that go back thousands of years.
And you've sort of got your finger on the pulse of China because you've been invited to go over there and speak to different groups?
Well, that's sort of been part of a slowly established sort of situation because I've always been a bit of a Sinophile, that kind of person who's into Chinese culture, history, that kind of thing, as long as I care to remember. But the side of it intersecting with UFOs has sort of been a sort of a hit and miss kind of affair for a long time because up till the end of the 1970s, China and UFOs was a bit of a closed door, like it was more generally because of the Cultural Revolution and the nature of the Chinese political system at that time. And it's only been since the late 70s that there's been this flowering of a kind of a fairly public UFO obsession, I guess you could call it, and it has many expressions, but it certainly has generated a very substantial UFO research movement, and that has also had to ride the whirlwind of the varied politicking that goes on within China, etc. And I think the Chinese UFO researchers have been very adept at knowing when to pull their heads in and take a low profile, particularly when the political winds change, and they can change fairly rapidly in China.
Sure. Well, we'll talk about government attitudes toward the subject. I want to talk about public attitudes first, though. You know, you were not able to hear my introduction at the beginning of the program, but, you know, it's been described to me that there are millions of Chinese that are in these UFO clubs and that every city has a big club, and I don't think there's anything comparable in the West that we could even imagine.
No, it's on a really quite a staggering scale. And that's something that I wanted to get a good sense of, or as best as I could, particularly during my first trip over there in 2002. Unfortunately, the timing of that was probably a bit of a problem because it was very difficult to get hold of the UFO researchers for one reason or another. I went over there for a couple of different reasons, and that was to sort of set up ties with DNA researchers, and that's... Now, I'll get into that later in terms of the DNA strategies that we've applied to UFO investigators, particularly alien abduction cases. But I met over there with a number of sort of scientists and people that were into the kind of the UFO subject, and the more strangest aspects, namely abductions, etc. But in terms of the established UFO groups, at that time in 2002, it was a little difficult to get hold of them. You know, emails weren't being answered or they'd bounce, websites were down, and I wonder what this was all about. You know, we did make contact with some of them, but as it turned out, the month before, members of Falun Gong had actually intercepted a radio station frequency and were broadcasting a lot of their material, etc., and that caused quite a kerfuffle in terms of security issues over there, and that's probably part of the good reason why it was very hard to make contact with researchers at the time.
But it's huge. It's huge.
It is definitely huge, and certainly particularly during 2005 when I attended a UFO conference at Dalian, which is this rather beautiful coastal city in northern China. The presence there was just huge. There were a huge number of researchers. Many of them have PhD engineering backgrounds, that kind of thing, scientific backgrounds, and so you get that kind of rich sort of aspect of scientific sensible interest, but you also get a very wide spectrum of interest trailing right down to the kinds of broad spectrum perspectives that you get here in the Western sort of attitude to science, to UFOs and that kind of thing. You get a lot of sort of pop interest and even New Age interest, but that generally is on the minority side of things. You tend to get a fairly objective kind of take on the subject there.
That's interesting that the scientists, Chinese scientists, are much freer to delve into this area without fear of being ridiculed or drummed out of the scientific establishment.
I have to qualify that by saying that there's still a healthy skeptical community in China, and part of that's being cultivated by the major skeptical organisation in America, PsyOps, etc. They've had visits over there and cultivated a number of the scientific researchers. So there is a healthy skeptical community over there as well that tends to engage with the UFO community. But in terms of public perception, UFO groups are taken pretty seriously, and they do get a fair bit of airtime, and they do get a lot of kind of feedback and some limited support from official circles as well.
Well, that's interesting. PsyCop is over there fomenting dissent and, skepticism, of course, in this field is a good thing, but that's it's different from debunkers.
I've said as much to the local chapter of the same group here in Australia. I've always suggested to them they should rename their group rather than the Skeptics. They should call themselves the Debunking Society rather than the Skeptical Society.
Well, we're going to take a break, Bill. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the Chinese government's attitude toward this and then get into a couple of these cases, including the Eclipse case that you mentioned. We're talking with Bill Chalker, author of The Oz Files and Hair of the Alien, about the Chinese and Australian UFO situations. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast. Welcome back. We're talking with Australia's preeminent UFO researcher, Bill Chalker, who's written a couple of really great books and has made some inroads into the Chinese UFO situation. Bill, I remember traveling to Russia a couple of times in the 90s and meeting with UFO researchers over there, and they were just coming out of a long, dark period after their government basically outlawed the discussion, certainly strongly discouraged it, and even today probably is not happy to see a whole lot of open discussion. How's the Chinese government? What's their attitude toward this?
Well, that's something I really got into in a big way, particularly during 2006. That was my third visit to China. I had a kind of a roundtable meeting with a substantial number of Chinese UFO researchers. Most of these were based in Beijing, and they were a broad cross-section of the researchers there. And one of them was highlighting how the major national UFO group, and that's CURO, they call it CURO, Chinese UFO Research Organization in English, but all the groups pretty much are affiliated in some form or another with CURO. So that's the national umbrella group. And that organization does have some sort of affiliation with the Academy of Science. And that really surprised me. I sort of thought certainly organizations like the Chemical Society and the Physics Society and that kind of thing in the West have fairly direct connections with the scientific academies and that kind of thing. But to have a UFO organization affiliated seemed to me, by Western standards, pretty unusual. And there is a connection, and it was explained to me that that connection existed, but it was at a fairly low level, but it was recognized within the Chinese Science Academy. So that's pretty unusual, and they have had limited funding from government organizations in the past, but only on a very limited kind of basis. And knowing China and the situation, the political situation there, like a lot of different organizations, that affiliation draws them into, I guess, public and government inspection, allows them to be fairly closely watched and monitored and that kind of thing. And so they do their best to toe the appropriate line, stay with a scientific focus. As long as they do that, there's no real issues. But if they do go down a political path or get too much into the mystical kind of religious kind of thing, you know, particularly obvious example is Falun Gong. Unfortunately, the Falun Gong founder, who's based in California now, I think, has made some comments about aliens and extraterrestrials and that kind of thing, and that led to a bit of an unfortunate tarring of with the brush of that kind of mysticism. And the big problem is, you know, a lot of people obviously have mixed feelings about the suppression of Falun Gong in China. And part of the problem, I guess, from the Chinese government perspective is that most of the major dislocations in Chinese society, particularly that have led to large numbers of deaths, et cetera, have been connected in some form or another with sort of mystical organizations. The main example would be the Taiping Rebellion back in the 1850s, 1860s, where tens of millions of people died and more than a third of China was taken over by the leader of the Taiping Rebellion, who saw himself as the Chinese brother of Jesus Christ or the Son of God. But it was kind of a peculiar mix of Western religion, Chinese religion, that kind of thing. And so I can understand to a certain extent the suppression of Falun Gong. That's why groups over there need to be careful in terms of their associations and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so the idea that Falun Gong embraces the study of UFOs and they embrace the idea that aliens are out there, suddenly the Chinese government looks at the topic as something that's being used by Falun Gong. I can see that leads to trouble.
Yeah, well, I've got mixed feelings about Falun Gong, but I've also looked in detail at the leader's belief system as far as UFOs and aliens are concerned, and I think you and I would regard it as pretty out there and pretty wild.
Wacky.
And certainly not into the mainstream of sort of legitimate scientific research and subjects. So as I say, most of the groups there stay on that sort of pretty much on that mainstream scientifically orientated path.
Any kind of a hint that their government or military has done any kind of studies like so many governments and militaries around the world have done?
There have been a range of kind of signals or indications that that has occurred. It's very difficult to drill down into Chinese government kind of official documentation now because of that long history of, the whole kind of nature of the process there has been largely suppressed, even more so than what occurs in the West. But various government-related documents have surfaced. Confirmations of military pilot cases have come up. But as far as the overall kind of policy and approach, et cetera, that's a little bit more apocryphal. And I've had information given to me by a number of different parties, including ones from Western business people that have had strong and deep enduring relationships with the Chinese government, even back as early as the 1960s through to the 1970s and 1980s, and continuing affiliations. And one of those had very close connections with high Chinese officials, including Chiang Lai, and who was Mao's number two. And he indicated that Chiang Lai even indicated that there was appearances of strange lights, blue objects, etc., that accompanied the Long March. The historical Long March. At that time they seemed to attach some significance to it in the sense of the idea of it being a portend of a good future and that kind of stuff. But Chiang Lai, according to this informant, told him that this occurred and that there was widespread knowledge of the of this kind of thing happening in China. But as far as the 60s and 70s were concerned, it was a strictly secretive approach to it, and that there was an indication that there were established official investigators. These were usually engineer types or that would operate out of some of the secret industrial facilities that were set up under Chairman Mao's arrangement because of the fear of nuclear retaliation, not only from the West, but also from the Russians, etc. The Chinese or Mao instigated something that was called the third wave, or the to relocate all the substantial military industrial sort of facilities inland away from the coastal areas, etc., to make them a little bit more better protected. And a lot of these facilities were like huge cities that were built into mountains, underground, that kind of thing. And it was out of that kind of environment that some of these investigators would operate, particularly around Chengdu and a number of other locations. And one of my informants had indicated that he had been told all of this and met a lot of the key investigators. So there certainly was an established kind of secret investigation that's been ongoing for some time.
Well, we probably shouldn't hold our breath waiting for them to release the secret files like the Ministry of Defense in Britain or Brazil or any of the other...
I think it'll be sometime coming, particularly when it's so difficult to get a lot of things that we would consider easy to get hold of. You can't get hold of those readily in China. So I think it'll be a long time coming.
And you'd have to figure, I mean, what we know of the Chinese system, and they've come a long way, obviously, in a short period of time. But, I mean, these guys are control freaks. They watch everything in their country. They watch what people do on the Internet. They limit it. You'd have to figure if they're seeing UFOs, if the public is interested in UFOs, that their government has to be monitoring it on some level.
Well, relatively speaking, I would have said that the British government were control freaks as well. They had an absolute obsession with secrecy that stood them in good stead during World War II, you know, with all the secrecy and the deception programs that they operated. But, the Chinese government seems to be down the path. And I can understand that, obviously, with something that you don't readily control or don't fully understand or have a control of, you would tend to keep that fairly well under control and just allow limited investigations, etc. And that's essentially what seems to be operating with the civilian groups. There's a great deal of tolerance to them, etc., providing they follow, you know, the appropriate paths of focusing on scientific investigations and not straying into political or too way out kind of New Age, mystical, religious type aspects. So that approach is, I think, made the group sort of last for quite some time.
And you, as a foreigner, as a visitor, are you able to move freely around, talk to who you want? Do you have a feeling you were followed or monitored in any extent?
Well, the only difficulty I had, which was a fairly minor difficulty, just to clarify, I've had three extended visits to China with a UFO focus, and that was in 2002, 2005, and 2006. The 2002 I referred to briefly, where there was a case of a low profile of UFO researchers operating because of the possible Falun Gong sort of connections or whatever. But 2005 was much more rewarding because of being involved with the Dalian UFO conference. And the only other Westerner over there was Stan Friedman. He was being chaperoned by Moon Fong from the Hong Kong UFO group. But Stan essentially came in and gave his lecture and basically left. I was there really mainly involved in fairly intensive discussions with translators and interpreters with a lot of the key researchers. So I got hours and hours of video translated material out of that whole exercise. So that I went in deliberately to do that, and also to present the DNA focus, the approach of using the DNA approach to forensically look at particularly alien abduction cases.
Well, we're going to get into that. We're going to get into your Hair of the Alien case. And before we leave this Chinese subject, a couple of the cases that have made headlines here in the West when we come back. Stay with us. Bill Chalker, preeminent UFO researcher from Australia, author of Hair of the Alien and the Oz Files, is our guest. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast. Welcome back. Our guest, Bill Chalker. We're talking about the China UFO scene. Bill, I don't know if you heard the tease or not, but the headline was about this mega UFO event, millions see motherships, photos were taken presumably video. Have you seen any of these photos?
I have. You know, some of it's quite interesting, and but there's also attempts at various explanations, etc. And I think it's sort of, I think listeners have to remind themselves that, you know, even sort of cases that receive a lot of spectacular attention, like the Steubenville lights and that kind of stuff, take a long time to unravel, and it's even more so in China to try and get to the bottom of these things. You know, one of the cases that's regarded as one of the classic cases in terms of a major case in China was one of these mass sightings that millions of people across China saw. Similar events to what's being reported here, but this was way back in 1981, and yet even now there's still debate amongst Chinese scientists and UFO researchers as to what happened. And so things move somewhat slower and with a lot more impediments and difficulties in China. And so I wouldn't sort of I guess, speculate too broadly about things that have just happened in the last couple of months. But it's certainly being officially reported. It's turning up in CNN.com, China Daily, all that kind of stuff. So these kinds of stories are getting officially reported. So that they do have some credibility as to the actual explanation, or whether it's a bona fide UFO event remains to be seen. That's going to have to wait until sort of very detailed investigations have been undertaken.
Well, on the subject of detailed investigations, there's this case come out of China, the Purple Mountain Observatory. The Chinese Academy of Sciences talked about this thing that scientists at this observatory, which is pretty well known in astronomical circles, I guess. And they said that they saw this thing, they videotaped it, and they're going to study it for the next 12 months, which I don't know why it takes 12 months, but what do you know about that one?
Well, that one is a somewhat of a classic lost in translation case. I'll back up a little bit because I was taking a big interest in UFO events that were occurring during the total eclipse back on July 22nd. They had, I think it was 22nd, there was a total eclipse, one of the longest running total eclipses, and so various scientific bodies, including Purple Mountain Observatory, which is regarded as one of the leading observatories in China, were broadcasting and making appeals to people and giving them sort of advice about what to do, how to observe it, and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of preparation, a lot of publicity given to the coming eclipse. And most people were obviously expecting just to see the eclipse, and that's pretty much what millions of people around China experienced. There were a number of cases, particularly down in southern China in Guangdong province. There was a situation there where a number of students had taken photographs. Now, these are the photographs that have done the rounds on the web and have appeared in British newspapers, including the Mail and that kind of thing. And they've been sort of incorrectly connected to the Purple Mountain Observatory story, but those photographs were taken by a number of students, and the three that have done the rounds to begin with, one of the photographs shows a sort of a satin-shaped type of appearance. It's a pretty impressive-looking photograph, but I'm always a little bit careful about these kinds of cases. I know it'll be controversial, but I have mixed feelings about the Mexican eclipse video that was back in 91 that a lot of people argue that UFOs were filmed during a total eclipse there. Well, I don't agree with that, but that probably get me off side with Jaime Masson. But
that's okay. What was it? What do you think it was?
Well, what I did at the time was that I was in contact with Australian eclipse researchers who were observing the total eclipse in Mexico on the Yucatan Peninsula, and they had a live video feed to Mexico City where most of these so-called UFO videos were taken during the total eclipse. And the angles and directions that these various videos were taken suggested that all they got on footage was basically Venus being made much more visible because of the total darkness and total eclipse effects that take place. And that's what the astronomers were observing. And the last place they wanted to be to observe the eclipse was in Mexico City because of its pollution situation. And but they were looking at a live video feed of what was being seen from Mexico City, and they just thought it was laughable that people were reporting UFOs from Mexico City, particularly the stuff that was being observed. But clearly, a lot of unusual and unexplained things go on in Mexico, and I'll be the last to reject all these reports. But as far as the eclipse video is concerned, I felt a little less than compelled by the whole story.
Well, there you go. That's the difference between a skeptic and a debunker. You're skeptical of it, but you're not writing all of it off.
No, but the reason why I don't accept that particular case was that I had contact with actual eclipse researchers who were there for the eclipse and who were observing on video, live feed, the sky from Mexico City. But they were better located at Yucatan Peninsula, where there was much better air transparency. Now, I wouldn't rule out that UFOs appear during total eclipses, that kind of thing, because we had one quite striking case from Australia here back in 1976, and most eclipse people that were interested in the eclipse were at Mount Gambier, and I was there as well during October of 1976 for the total eclipse, and they were at a UFO conference of all things as well, but a lot of UFO researchers are into astronomy as well, so we thought we'd kill two birds with one stone, do the UFO conference and watch the eclipse. And unfortunately for us, there was substantial activity, but not at Mount Gambier. It was on the south coast of New South Wales, at a place called Ben Boyd National Park, where other eclipses, or a small gathering of a couple of dozen, had gathered together at Ben Boyd National Park. And just before the eclipse was beginning, they observed a couple of dish-shaped objects out to sea and were able to film these and take photographs of them. And these were been examined by my group way back in the late 70s, et cetera, and we were able to confirm that, you know, we were dealing with a sort of a bona fide UFO event that occurred just prior to a total eclipse. But unfortunately, we weren't there.
Is that one of your top 10? I know you got a top 10 list on your site. Is that one of your top 10?
Well, that would be up there in terms of one of the very important types of cases because of the gathering of photographic evidence. And back then, the problem that we have with much of the photography that occurs today with Photoshop and, you know, the ability to be able to create any kind of visual effect that you want. You know, we're talking different kind of photographic technology back then. It certainly didn't preclude a hoax, but because of the multiple witnesses involved, we were able to confirm that this was a real case, and we appeared to have captured bona fide UFOs. So, you know, the case remains open. And getting back to China, we had the situation here where we might have got bona fide photographs there back down in Guangdong province. At that location, they didn't have a total eclipse. They had about 50 to 75% totality. So you still got some light occurring during that sequence. But as far as the Purple Mountain photographs are concerned, that appeared to be lost in translation, because certainly the Purple Mountain Observatory people did release the fact that they had captured in the corona of the eclipse what appeared to be an unexplained object. And the director of the Purple Mountain Observatory, who initially released the information, had to clarify that he did not say that it was an unidentified flying object. He said it was an unknown object, which would take them some while to clarify what it was, hence the year of detailed investigative work. And that's the way science operates, etc. Things don't readily get explained straight away, and there's a lot of work and effort required to come up with a bona fide explanation. So I accept that, because actually at the Dalian conference, I met one of the astronomers from Purple Mountain, who's a UFO researcher, a very keen UFO researcher. In fact, he's the one that produced a lot of the recent data on the 1981 China-wide UFO sightings of these huge, giant UFO spiral effects that have been observed and that kind of thing. So they're open to it, so I don't necessarily cry out wolf and say that there's a cover-up going on here. I think that as far as the Purple Mountain Observatory side of things, it's unexplained, but it's probably not what we would call a UFO. It's some sort of an unexplained object or a star or some sort of astronomical body. Some of the photos doing the rounds that have been connected by various commentators as being the imagery from the Purple Mountain Observatory from July of this year, I think, look to me like what I would call Bailey's beads effects on the corona during totality. Any astronomy buff would understand what that's about. Because the various light burst effects. But there are other photographs that are linked to the Purple Mountain Observatory photos that show a bright white object some distance away from the corona. So it's hard to know what we're dealing with here, but all of that's going to take some time to unravel. But
okay, one other question about China, and then we'll move on to other things. Is you ever hear anything about a Chinese Roswell or some really spectacular case that's been well documented that maybe we in the West don't know about that you were impressed by?
Well, in terms of UFO crash stories, they do have them, but none of them have been compellingly documented in the manner of which Roswell and others have been documented. I'm still a bit of open mind with regard to Roswell. It's, I know it's sacred cow territory, but I'm kind of Roswelled out, etc. even after all these many decades, we still don't have resolution about Roswell. But there are many, many other crashed UFO cases during the rounds, even here in Australia and in China, and still await resolution. And you know, it's a difficult area to work in. But when I went to China in 2005, I went there deliberately to focus on alien abduction stories to try and compare them to what might be occurring in the West and that kind of thing. And there were some very impressive cases, particularly two that are quite well known over there. The major case is the Meng Jiao Gao case from Harbin.
Well, describe it. Describe
it. It's a very bizarre abduction case by even Western standards. Its closest approximation would be the Antonio Villa-Boas case from Brazil in 1957, where there was this sexual encounter between aliens and Antonio Villa-Boas. Well, in the Meng Jiao Gao case, there was this element of, well, there are two aspects of it, really, where there was a multiple witness observation of a UFO sort of perched or that had landed on and perched itself on top of a mountain called Phoenix Mountain there. And Meng Jiao Gao was amongst many who observed that. He and a friend tried to climb the mountain to get closer to the object. He allegedly was struck by a beam of light from the UFO. And that's when the story gets pretty weird, because that aspect of it appears to be fairly well documented and corroborated by other witnesses, but then it gets into the whole alien abduction contact aspect, which only really you have Meng Jiao Gao's word, and that's where we get sort of stories of a sexual encounter with the alien, a female alien, and all sorts of contactee messages that sort of flowed through it. And this case became the subject of very intensive investigation by a lot of the prominent UFO researchers. And I had the opportunity to speak to one of the key researchers there, who was a professor in computer science at Harbin University. And he was very impressed by the case. And in fact, I've been working on a translation of his very detailed report on the case. But it's a very complex kind of case. And the other case was Gao Gong, a Beijing gentleman, a practitioner in traditional medicine, who was abducted and taken to a location, seaside port city, directly east of Beijing, many hundreds of miles, etc. And in that abduction, he was taken into a room inside the UFO, where he encountered a young Chinese girl who appeared to be in a fairly distressed, ill state, and he seemingly was being asked by the aliens to undertake some sort of healing exercise on this young girl, and he was all being instructed in some way how to do this, but also to incorporate traditional Chinese techniques, medical techniques, that kind of thing. And this is a very bizarre case, but very interesting case. So I got to meet the gentleman involved while I was in Beijing, and it's certainly an interesting story. And I've also got access to the detailed investigation records, and I've had all those translated. So it's one of the more impressive abduction-style cases that have occurred in China, particularly because while this gentleman didn't know the young girl that he encountered inside the craft, he became so obsessed by the experience that he tried to track them. And one of the investigators, key investigators in China, Xinjing Zhang, who I've become quite friendly with in Beijing, he instigated a couple of interesting exercises where he got one of the leading police computer artists to generate an image of the Chinese girl that Gao Gong saw on board the craft, and they generated this artwork of the girl. And then utilising something like about 100 to 200 university students, they went to the location involved and spent a number of days there scouting around the area, and they managed to, believe it or not, allegedly locate the girl involved.
Oh, my gosh.
And they brought her to Beijing. They did all sorts of medical studies of her as well. She unfortunately has some sort of impaired mental capacity, but nevertheless... she hasn't actually confirmed the experience, but there were certain unusual marks on the body and that kind of stuff. So it's a very interesting but also very controversial case as well.
As if somebody selected her because of her condition, maybe.
Well, that's possible, because one of the things that interested me the most, apart from the DNA aspects of the case and all that kind of thing, which I was trying to preach to the Chinese researchers to get involved with, another aspect that I've always been interested in terms of UFO research is these cases that involve solid light. Now, for listeners who aren't familiar with that concept, there are many UFO cases where light behaves in ways that we just don't understand, where it seems to bend or behave like a solid tube, or it's used as a sort of a transport device or whatever. Light in UFO cases, projected beams and that kind of stuff, don't seem to behave in the way that we understand. And in this case, while Gao Gong was being asked to undertake a healing sort of experiment with this young Chinese girl, the aliens allegedly put something like a torch-type device on top of her head, and from that projected a solid light effect which seemed to flow over the girl and envelop her in something that became like a solid light dome around the girl, and all sorts of sort of gas or light effects occurred while the girl was underneath this kind of, raincoat, umbrella, shroud type of effect that was created by the solid light effect. And Gao Gong believed that this must have been part of the combined curative attempt on this girl. He obviously couldn't understand what was going on. But it's certainly an interesting aspect of the case.
Wow. Hey, that sounds like a pretty good subject for a book, because those of us in the Western world would like to read about that. But Bill, get on it.
it's something that I'm obviously working on, and I hope to get something out by next year sometime.
Yeah, let us know about that. I want to transition. We're going to take a break in just a couple of minutes, but I want to transition to the Australian UFO scene. You're a chemist. You're a scientist. You travel in scientific circles. It's how you make your living. Do you catch much grief because of your interest in this topic? Is it similar in Australia to the situation in the U.S.?
No, I've actually not sort of got much grief. I've basically been fairly open about it, and I know it, but I also appreciate that it is very difficult for a lot of researchers to be, or particularly scientists and that kind of stuff, to be too high profile about it, particularly if they're in sensitive, politicized type of positions.
Sure. Well, we're going to take our break now, Bill. When we come back, we're going to talk about this preeminent case that you've been working on, the hair of the DNA, some fascinating DNA evidence that you've acquired from an alien abduction case, and it's a real page-turner. Stay with us. Our conversation with Bill Chalker here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Chalker, a UFO researcher from Australia, a scientist who's been on the trail of these mysteries for a long time. And he's come across a case, been working on it for a long time, and it is extraordinary by any stretch of the imagination. It is, sort of the focus of one of his books, Hair of the Alien. He continues to work on it and gather information. It led to DNA evidence that I'm not sure it's available from any other case in the world. Bill, walk us through it. Tell us the events, how they happened, who the people are involved, and what the circumstances were.
Yeah, well, I'll try and make it simple as possible. It's essentially, I sort of see it as sort of falling into four main phases, and I'll discuss that along the way. But just in a general context, as you've highlighted, this is a really major case. It's a kind of a breakthrough case as far as I'm concerned, and in terms of the number of the scientists that are working with me on this case, And it obviously led to the book being published, which is essentially equivalent to phase two of the investigation. So we've got phase three and phase four, which I'll explain in terms of the way it's evolved. But this case, probably more than any other, for me at least anyway, has been incredibly enriching in terms of trying to get to a central understanding of what's going on, particularly with these so-called alien abduction cases. And it's had the obviously the benefit of allowing me to follow this process through as much as possible. It's led to a bit of unfettered funding as well. It's allowed me to investigate this in depth, and quite often you don't get that opportunity because of limited funding to do this. And it's led to all sorts of aspects, i.e. travelling to northern Thailand to do investigations related to this case, and also into southern China and meeting up with researchers like Zhang Jinping and Chen Gongfu and Sun Xili and that kind of thing to look into this Chinese aspect of it. So just in simple terms, I guess the way to look at it is that nearly all the alien abduction cases are kind of generally absent of what would be classed as compelling scientific evidence, so something you could look at and examine and verify. And so a lot of scientists, while interested in the subject, are somewhat put off by this absence of compelling physical evidence. And I know from my own personal scientific perspective, that's something that's been particularly frustrating about alien abduction cases. While many of the cases are very compelling and some of the witnesses are very impressive, you're always left with this difficulty of reconciling it to the kind of reality that most folks accept on a day-to-day basis. And so you have a dilemma there, compelling stories, but unfortunately a lack of compelling evidence to back them up.
This one's different. So what happened? What happened to the people involved?
Right. Well, basically, the key character involved in this is a Sydney man, of Lebanese background. He immigrated to Australia. His family is a Christian Maronite background from Lebanon. They sort of left all the military conflict there, and so the family settled in Australia back in the late 70s. And basically, he grew up pretty much in Australia, started to learn a building trade, that kind of stuff. Live life and all that kind of stuff. Had no contact whatsoever with the UFO subject. And in fact, it was almost totally foreign to his worldview. Back, all this kind of changed back in 1988 when he had an experience, a classic kind of alien abduction experience. That the kind of thing that people are used to, little grey beings, that kind of thing. A needle was put into his head. This thing was completely shattering to his worldview. He had no context in which to understand this because UFOs weren't something that he was very familiar with, and let alone this concept of alien abduction. So he just wasn't that well read on it, and didn't have an awareness of it. And so he had no context, and he was trying to figure out what had happened to him. And initially, they tried to incorporate it into their kind of religious viewpoint that maybe it was the Saint Charbel, one of the first saints of the Christian Maronite religion. None of this kind of sat well with him, you know, because it just these things were clearly not human that he encountered. And
well, who tried to push that view on him?
Oh, well, his own family.
He had
difficulty trying to relate to this, and his own brother and father were involved in it to a certain extent, in the sense that they were there in the home that night when this experience occurred, but they were, I guess, in the classic alien context, shut off or switched off during this encounter. But they were aware that they themselves had a kind of missing time aspect. But and then here's their Peter telling them that he had this really bizarre experience. It was consciously recollected, and he had great difficulty trying to sort this out in his own mind. And it was not until with his fiancée, Vivian, that they were driving around several weeks after the experience that they started seeing these billboards with these huge faces, which we all would know as the grey alien face. Now, he didn't even know what this was, but he was astonished that here was a face of something that he'd experienced months before that he'd been struggling trying to put into context, and it turned out to be a fairly slick advertising campaign for the paperback edition of Whitley Strieber's Communion book. And as most of you folks might know, it had just the alien face on the cover in many editions of the book. No title, no nothing. They used the face of the grey alien to promote the book, and it clearly had a major effect. It sold millions of copies, but it also had this very profound effect on hundreds of people worldwide that had some sense of familiarity with the face on the cover of the book.
They see it and they go, hey, I've seen that before.
That's right. And so suddenly Peter thought, what the hell is this? And it took them a couple of weeks to figure out that this was an advertising campaign for this book, and they finally found the book. Vivian read it first and told Peter, you've got to read this, you know, this is about what happened to you. And he eventually read it, you know, he was not big on reading, but he got into it, and he eventually read it and thought, oh, there were many things that were similar to what happened to him, but just as many things that didn't happen to him. So at least he finally had a context, and that context was what we refer to as alien abductions. Now, he decided that he'd gone through so much flack associated with this, trying to get to some understanding. Even his own medical doctor sort of ridiculed him, said it was nothing. Even the mark on his head where a needle had been stuck into his head, the doctor suggested that he just had an accident on site and got impacted with a nail or something of that nature. Nobody really accepted it. And he took a fairly courageous move in the sense that he set up a support group that was probably one of the best expressions of an abductee support group that I've seen or come across. He had actually managed to get professional, health professional type people on board, some scientists, that kind of thing. And eventually that proceeded along, and it gave a lot of help to a lot of different people. But ultimately, it wasn't until a few years later in 1992 that he had another experience that was almost somewhat similar but startlingly different in many ways.
Hold on there, Bill. We need to take a short break. When we come back, I want you to pick up the story. Tell them about tell our audience about that second experience and how it led to the physical evidence that that you have analyzed. Stay with us. We're talking with Bill Chalker on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Bill Chalker picks up the story about this amazing abduction case that's described by a Sydney resident named Corey. First one happened in 1998. Aliens come into his house. I guess there's other people there with missing time. They stick a needle in his head. And then pick up the story, Bill. When does he have the second one?
Just to correct you there, it was 1988, the first experience.
But 1988, okay. Yeah,
the second experience was in 1992. Now, this thing was so bizarre that in the end he didn't really share it with many people. He had, as I said earlier, he was set up his own business as a cement rendering company, and did a lot of work on different houses and building sites, that kind of stuff. So it was a pretty busy job and that kind of thing. And he actually encountered some people trying to steal some of his equipment, and got into a bit of a confrontation with them, and ended up being very severely injured on the job as a consequence of this assault that took place at this building site. And he was recovering from this. It had received some head injuries, and was on a range of pain-killing medications, none of which, I should qualify, had any kind of hallucinatory consequences. You know, various skeptics have tried to suggest that his medication caused this experience. Well, it doesn't explain it because the medication didn't have this effect, and nor does it explain the physical evidence found. But the encounter, he had just dropped off his wife, who was the sole breadwinner at this point in time because he was still off work. This was 7 a.m. in the morning. He had dropped her off at the railway station, had returned to the house, had just lay down on the bed, was about to fall asleep, still awake, some sense that he wasn't sure whether he'd totally fully fallen asleep, I think, at this stage, and then he was suddenly made aware of something putting pressure on the bed. He thought a cat had jumped on the bed or something of that nature, became aware of the presence of two female people, beings or entities or whatever you'd like to refer to them as. One appeared to be classically Nordic in appearance, in the sense of very blonde hair, very large, prominent eyes that seem to be about 2 to 3 times the size of normal human eyes, and a very sharp kind of angular face, also what appeared to be an Asian-looking woman with dark hair and almost totally black eyes. And so both of them looked kind of human, but also had aspects that seemed to be a little different to your typical kind of human person. Now, both of these females were apparently naked, and to correct a lot of misapprehensions about this case, there was no recollected sexual encounter here, but Peter Curry, the gentleman involved, claimed that the blonde, sort of Nordic-looking person kind of took him by the arms or pulled him to her breast and did this several times. And now, Peter is a little claustrophobic at the best of times, and despite what seems to be something that almost has the context of a sexual fantasy, which this wasn't to him. This is the one thing that he was very firm about, that this thing was just so confronting and so bizarre that it was just not in that mindset, that he tried to push this person away. And he, surprisingly, now he's a very strong guy, being in the building trade, some kind of guy that you'd like to have in a dark alley on your side, you know, so he's no weakling. And yet he found this blonde, blue-eyed woman very, very strong. In fact, he confessed that she seemed to be much stronger than him, and something that was really quite confronting to him. Now, he kind of tried to push her away, and she kept doing this, and then it got to a stage where he literally bit her on the nipple, and there was that point that she sort of let him go. And at that point, he got some sort of mental message to the effect, like she was kind of telling the other woman, this Asian woman that was Asian-looking woman, president, that this is not the way it's supposed to happen. If she's somehow trying to communicate to her that this is what we do and this is not the way it goes about normally.
Like it's their first time.
Something like
her
that.
First time.
Well, and he couldn't understand where this was coming from, but he got this in his head as if it was kind of a ESP-type message or something of that nature. Now, at that point, he starts to cough, as if in reaction to what he had bitten or tried to bite. And he started to go into a really heavy-duty coughing fit and then looks up. And this is only in a matter of a very short period of time, looks up and the two female people are gone. Now, he starts to continue to cough. He goes in the bathroom to try to drink and to clear this coughing fit. Decides he needs to pass and urinate. He has this incredibly painful effect with his private part. At that point, he encounters this blonde hair that's attached to his private part. Now, this is a very controversial aspect of it, and most people would reject the story at this point in time, but because of the quality of the case and the investigation and our investigation of Peter and his background and the physical evidence, we decided let's look at this and see whether or not a detailed forensic investigation, a scientific investigation that's focused on DNA, could either refute Peter's story or support it. Now, to be quite honest, at the time when we looked at this, and it took us a number of years to get involved with this, because of its confronting nature, Peter talked to very few people. He talked to his own wife about this. She supported him on it. His own abductee support group. Now, he had his professional people. He was very reluctant to talk to them. He eventually did talk to them. Within a week or two of this experience taking place, basically he was kind of told, well, you know, Pete, your 1988 experience is like a traditional abduction experience. Let's kind of keep this one on the back burner and not talk about it. It's too far out. Now, that was too confronting and too difficult for them to handle, and ultimately it was kind of left on the back burner.
Back up for a second. So he finds this hair. What does he do with it?
Well,
does he preserve it somehow?
Well, the great thing for the subsequent research was that he removed this hair and immediately put it into a sealed plastic bag, one of those sort of sample-type bags, and put it inside a filing cabinet drawer. Now, that's a great thing to do and ultimately led to us at least having a somewhat viable sample to deal with later on, several years down the track. He tried to interest some his professional people to look at it, but none of them had the capacity or the ability to look at it in any kind of way, and plus it was a bit too way out in terms of traditional types of experiences. Now, it was only a few years later that I eventually got to know Peter, and at that time we had our kind of like an our group of anonymous scientists that were working together, and that group of people, including myself, started to include biochemist types. Now, my chemistry background is in physical chemistry, not biochemistry, and so the addition of biochemists amongst our group of scientists was quite welcome. And we're all lamenting at that stage the absence of compelling physical evidence for alien abduction cases, and we thought, and then we were starting to have a long discussion about this, and then suddenly it dawned on me that a year or two earlier, Peter had mentioned this business about the hair sample. And I thought, well, hang on a sec, this would be good to look at. And the DNA techniques had improved somewhat so that we could possibly do something with this. And that was the beginning that these biochemists then started to work with me to examine Peter's case. Now, they didn't reject Peter's story. They looked at it and decided, you know, he was a pretty impressive witness, seemed to be honest. Everything checked out, the chain of evidence checked out. Other people had seen the hair sample a short time after the event, that kind of thing. So all these things were fairly compelling aspects to the case, and so it was decided that we would go down the path of doing a very detailed, exhaustive, expensive, drawn-out DNA investigation of the hair sample.
And how expensive? How expensive is that?
Well, initially at that time, in terms of what we did and all the preparation work that we had to do, it cost us about $10,000. So that was done at pretty much the cost of the group of scientists that were working on it. Now, there were a lot of investigation aspects and preparation works and techniques that were developed, that kind of thing, to do this work. But fundamentally, in terms of what was called phase one, we followed pretty much the process that had been developed by Quantico, the FBI people, in terms of investigating hair that's left at crime scenes.
Okay, hold on there. Hold on, Bill. This is where it gets good. Stay with us when we come back. We get into the actual hair and the analysis and the amazing results that came back. Stay with us. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm George Knapp. All right, Bill Chalker, pick up the story. You have a sample there. You have some resources and a group willing to test it, unique in the annals of ufology. What do you find out?
Right. There are two phases to the actual test results here. The phase one results were reported in the International UFO Reporter in an article that came out in 1999 called Strange Evidence that I wrote. This is the name of the article that I wrote. That article is actually available as a PDF file on the web, I guess via the QFOS website or via my own website. And basically what that found was that we had what appeared to be a blonde hair sample that we could link to this blonde woman, entity, whatever you want to refer to her as, and that was examined using the technique that was pioneered by Kerry Mullis, who got the Nobel Prize in biochemistry for this. Now, he's unique amongst the Nobel Prize winners as being the only Nobel Prize winner to claim to have had an alien abduction experience, but that's another long story. But the basic results, we were expecting the results to confirm some sort of Caucasian sort of DNA profile, but surprisingly what we got from the shaft of the hair sample was a rare Asian mongoloid DNA profile. Now, this was quite unexpected, and that was the key kind of aspect that we we got here, that initially that this was sort of a conflicting DNA, an unusual and quite rare DNA sequence being found here, and that was essentially the substance behind what we found and reported in IOR back in 1999. That caused a bit of a stir when we put that report out, and then we undertook what we call phase two, which occurred a year or two later, once we'd, because we realised we were dealing with a fragile sample and a very limited sample here. We wanted to make sure we could do the easy part, or the relatively easy part, first. That gave us a sort of an inexplicable and unusual result. And then with phase two, which is reported in some detail in the book Air of the Island, which is available by Amazon, the really quite striking results were even more unusual than the first round. And that was that we then replicated the results in the shaft, got this rare Asian mongoloid DNA in what should have been a Caucasian-type DNA profile. In the root of the hair sample, we then got what appeared to be a rare Basque Gaelic kind of DNA profile. And one shouldn't be getting this kind of conflicting DNA profile. You should be getting a consistent DNA profile throughout the root and throughout the shaft. And yet here we had what appeared to be evidence supportive of the idea of this hybrid type profile that we're getting. And that, I guess, gives some substance to the idea or concept behind a lot of these abduction cases where you're dealing with sort of a hybrid type breeding program, that type of thing. But I should caution listeners that this is not absolute proof, because I'd be much more comfortable if we had hundreds of samples like this. Unfortunately, we've only got one in this case. But what we had here was some pretty unusual DNA properties that the DNA specialists couldn't explain. The hybrid aspect of it was quite inexplicable as well. And in addition, we looked at the nuclear DNA aspects of it. And in that, we got evidence supportive of the idea that it also had another unusual DNA factor, and that was the possible presence of what's called a CCR5 deletion factor. Now, what that implies is that the donor of the hair sample was immune to things like HIV and smallpox, that kind of thing. CCR5 deletion factor is a rare factor that is unfortunately not present widely amongst Asian communities or African communities, or indeed worldwide. It's present in pockets of amongst humans, particularly in Scandinavian communities and various communities around the world. But it's fairly scattered in its occurrence. And if you've got that CCR5 deletion factor, then you don't have a problem with HIV or AIDS or smallpox, that kind of thing. So it's a pretty unusual array. Now, collectively, these DNA factors or aspects that were found make for a fairly unusual DNA profile. And that's where the matter rested as far as phase one and phase two, as reported by up till in the book Hair of the Island. Now, we were always interested in what this unusual Asian mongoloid DNA was, because we had biochemists working with us trying to track that aspect down. And usually when we did find that there were some people, a handful of people that had this, but their locations and details were anonymous because it's part of a DNA database. And it was a Chinese DNA database, and so it was more difficult to try and track that down. But ultimately, to cut a long story short, we did track that down, and that was really the focus of what we call the Phase 3 investigation that took us to northern Thailand and to southern China. What we found was that DNA sequence appeared to be unique to a small ethnic group called the Lahu, who are a tribal people that are mainly located in the northern Thailand area, through Laos and Cambodia and up through southern China.
Well, hold on a second. You said you saw similarities for the whole sequence? I mean, the rare Asian mongoloid DNA, the Gaelic stuff, the Scandinavian stuff?
No, I'm talking particularly the phase one, the rare Asian mongoloid DNA that we found in the shaft of the hair.
I guess what I'm asking is there anywhere in the world that you've seen this combination in one hair or one sample?
No. No. And that's the actual significance of this, all this work we've done. It would not be easy, not impossible, but it would not be easy to create this hair sample or to encounter a person or a human being wandering around that has this sequence. Particularly in the context that Peter encountered and acquired this hair sample. When I say that this rare Asian mongoloid DNA sequence seemed to be connected with the Lahu people, located in northern Thailand and southern China, it's not beyond the realm of possibilities that this, you know, you could have had this person marrying with a Caucasian person from Scandinavia and creating some sour hybrid DNA sequence that also had the CCR factor, which would be incredibly rare amongst Asian people. All of these are major assumptions that one can't really make up, and then also have this person turning up in what appeared to be a very bizarre context with Peter Kuri back in 1992.
All right, these Lahu people, anything unusual in their background and their history in terms of their own lore about interest in these kinds of topics?
Well, that's where it all gets interesting, because they do have this aspect. They do have sort of sky lore beings, etc. I went there basically trying to see whether there was this kind of aspect to it, whether they had what appears to be quite frequent amongst various indigenous cultures around the world, where a lot of them seem to claim some connections with sky beings or superior beings that come from the sky, that kind of thing, and they have that element to them. There was some interesting unusual UFO or light phenomena going on in the area. The Yunnan province area has a lot of UFO-type cases going on. One thing you do have common throughout these cultures is that you have what appears to be like a shaman figure, a witch doctor-type figure. And in the Lahu belief systems and even in modern times, there's been shamans that have claimed to have received even physical material from these beings, these sky beings or their gods, and there's a anthropological book that shows like a written tablet, somewhat similar to a story like told by Moses in the Bible, where he's given this from these superior beings, and that the same shaman, and this has occurred in recent times, several decades ago, where he had observations of lights in the sky and shapes or unusual circular shapes moving across the sun, that kind of stuff. So there's all sorts of interesting and peculiar aspects associated with this that really move us into what I call now the phase four thing, where we're looking and focusing on essentially what I call like this global alien DNA nexus type thing, where we're looking for evidence of the combination where you've got locations with high strangeness or breakthrough activities with UFOs, like phenomena, alien abductions. You've got cultures that feature sky being claims, diverse UFO phenomena. You've got unusual DNA markers within these cultures, and possibly selectively or generically in human DNA. And the locations where all these factors come together is what really is the focus of this whole phase four approach. And we've found it amongst the Lahu to a certain extent. It appears to be amongst the Zulu, the Maori in New Zealand, one of the several tribes in South America, that kind of thing. So to me, it's a very promising area of investigation where this kind of possible alien presence that's somehow been tampering with our DNA over hundreds of years or thousands of years, this is a possible pathway to proving that kind of aspect, and also goes towards trying to explain these various claims of people in alien abduction situations where they're seeing hybrid beings or people that appear to be part human, part alien, that kind of thing. So it's a pretty controversial investigation, but it's also being backed up by a lot of interesting science.
Well, help me understand this. You mentioned the Lahu and the Maori, and it seems like if there is some other intelligence behind this kind of thing, they've selected some interesting and isolated groups to interact with?
Yeah, well, that's part of the focus of this. You know, for example, one classic group that's been looked at to a certain extent, but their DNA aspects haven't been examined properly in full detail yet, and that's the Caiapó people in Brazil, where they have this long-term tradition of interacting with a being called the Bepcorati, where they have this yearly tradition where they dress up in like a, it looks, resembles like a straw space suit, and they carry a long stick they call a cope or a device. And the tradition is amongst the Caiapó Brazilian natives is that this sky being came to them and visited them and interacted with them, and even got to the point where he became quite friendly and even had relations with some of the Caiapó women and bore children. And the Caiapó claim that their origins are from above, and that it would be very interesting to examine the Caiapó's background in terms of any unusual DNA factors that might occur there. And that goes for a lot of these different ethnic groups around the world.
Well, let me ask you to speculate just a little bit. What the heck does that mean, that these, if there are some kind of visitors experimenting with hybrids, DNA, that sort of thing, that they've selected isolated populations around the world to do the experimentation?
Well, that is one of the aspects that could be possible in this. Now, I'm a firm believer in evolution, et cetera. I'm certainly not a believer in intelligent design, particularly the style of that's presented to us as a kind of a cover for creationist type approaches to it all. So I'm a firm believer in the scientific aspects of evolution, but what is interesting is the possibility of, along the way, intelligent intervention, where you've got some unusual aspects to our own human DNA that keep popping up, and that privately a lot of biochemists will discuss this. And I've had some pretty interesting discussions with the DNA people and the biochemist people working with me, where they will speculate pretty wildly and pretty prolifically about some of these unusual DNA aspects that keep popping up. Now, even the factor of CCR5, deletion factor, now that's being extensively studied, particularly for its possibilities as a way of getting past the scourge of AIDS and HIV. And yet there's some argument about the origins of that factor in the human DNA, how did it arrive? And the standard explanation is that it was due to environmental sort of plague pressures during, the plague periods during the Middle Ages. Now, that doesn't really factor in too well when you realise that usually these mutations that appear in DNA come about due to things like the plague and stuff like this, and you would therefore expect that the CCR deletion factor would be very prevalent amongst Asian and African communities, where unfortunately things like HIV and AIDS are very prominent, and yet they're virtually absent amongst those communities. So there's a lot of issues and discussions. Unfortunately, because of the nature of these speculations, it's not something that your standard biochemist will come out and speculate about in a scientific paper, because it would be the end of his career path. So,
back to the hair. I don't know how long of a piece of hair it was. I imagine some of this testing has to be destructive. How much of the hair do you have left?
We only have very limited parts of the hair left. And that's why we went at this in a very careful way. Now, the work that was being done, I haven't really gone into the science of it because it would be obviously too complex, but that has been reproduced in the book Hair of the Alien. It has been examined by other biochemists. Even your co-author, Dr. Colm Kellner, became aware of this stuff, and we worked with Colm Kellner in terms of looking at other cases, other abduction cases where biological evidence has come along. For example, we looked at, particularly with Colm, the Californian alien claw case. Now, that turned out to be a cautionary tale because it demonstrated the power of the DNA technique or the forensic approach to these sorts of investigations, because while the case itself might have its merits, the actual claw involved in this turned out to be, based on the DNA work that we did, turned out to be quite prosaic in the sense that it turned out to be a terrestrial mollusk in other words, a snail.
Well, that's a good thing, though, to be able to use that evidence to weed things out.
Yeah, we even applied it to things. We got involved with looking at Betty Hill's dress that factored in the classic alien abduction case from 1961. And in that case, we were able to verify that this, what appeared to be a strange stain on her dress that was being speculated as being possibly alien in nature, turned out to be, of all things, spider's blood. And we were able to type it to a species of spider that came from the New Hampshire area. So it's a fairly powerful technique, and that it really allows us to have this ability to put a little bit of certainty into these alien abduction stories where uncertainty and controversy was the main game.
Let me put you on the spot a little bit, and I know you're uncomfortable speculating, but just to go out on a limb just a little bit, what the heck does this mean? I mean, what is the possible scenario wherein this guy, Mr. Corey, is visited by these two female beings? They are having some kind of an interaction that's not really clear. And then you track down the connection to all these isolated tribes. What does it mean?
Well, I think it means that, or potentially means that the alien presence or the intervention into human society has been going on in a way that's a lot bigger than we previously thought, and has been going on for a lot longer than perhaps we've thought, and that perhaps these stories or myths that have been told by of these primitive cultures has some truth to it. And one of the ways that where we might to be able to ultimately establish the truth of some of these sky being claims is to perhaps look at the DNA of those ethnic tribes today and to see whether there are unusual DNA factors that occur, and already in some cases that seems to be possible.
I would think that'd be pretty tricky work, wouldn't it? Talking them into that.
It is extremely tricky work because the origins of some of these unusual DNA markers and things that come up are debated in great detail amongst the biochemistry community.
Bill, hang on. We're talking with Bill Chalker about the hair of the alien case, but there's a lot more. Mothman prophecies down under and other physical trace cases that he has investigated. And when we come back, we'll open up the phone lines for your questions. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for staying up with us tonight, everyone. We're talking with Bill Chalker. Just heard the story of the hair of the alien case down there in Australia, and it's leading to interesting places with physical evidence to analyze. Bill, before we leave this part of the topic and open up the phone lines, I'm curious about the general abduction scenario in Australia. Is it pretty much the same that we hear about here in the States, both in the frequency and the nature of the cases?
Largely speaking, it is, and you have that kind of consistent phenomenon, and I think that's what makes it so interesting as a phenomenon to study, and why I guess the work that we've been doing with these biochemists and other researchers is so interesting, is that it's presenting a bit of real science and applying that to a very controversial field, and perhaps lending a little bit of certainty or a little bit of understanding to what might be at the heart of all this, i.e. the nature of the these alleged aliens that are intruding into our society, that they may have been visiting us for a long period of time, and that maybe they too have DNA, what might well in fact be a universal molecule out there. And this is one of the areas of controversy amongst biochemistry and research at the moment. One of the major evolutionary biologists out there, guy by the name of Simon Conway Morris, has published a book called Life Solutions, where the subtitle is Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe, where he argues that given the right opportunities on a habitable planet, humans ultimately will play out in pretty much the same way as we have here on Earth. And that's a fairly provocative and pretty revolutionary finding, becoming from one of the leading biochemists in this area.
And is this a solvable mystery, do you think?
Well, I think that's part of the lesson with this strategy that I've been applying, is that we should be using science as our ally in this investigation. You know, the history of science in this UFO subject is so fraught with controversy and highly politicized and militarized science, where you've got the notorious Condon Report and that kind of thing. And yet if real science is applied to it, And I think that, you know, the book that you did with Cole Kellner, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, is a classic example of this. If you have the funding and the backup to do it, if you apply a bit of science and some heavy-duty data and equipment into controversial situations such as the Skinwalker Ranch, you can come up with some really interesting data.
You know, maybe, you know, this is just speculation, but maybe it's the journey, it's the process that's the that's important as opposed to the ultimate answer.
Well, I'm enjoying the journey that I've been on for the last 10 years and prior to that as well. But it's I think we'll get to an answer on this, providing a lot of commitments involved as well. That's got to involve a fair bit of science as well.
One other question before we go to the phones. You know, the range of views on this alien abduction scenario range from, you know, very light and breezy, we welcome our space brethren, they're here to help us, to very dark sort of things, that they're here to exploit us, we're their slaves, they're stealing our DNA, that kind of thing. Without asking you to contaminate your future research, where do you fall on that scale, or do you fall anywhere?
Well, the other aspect is outright complete rejection that none of this is happening.
Sure.
And that's where I think the value of the work I've been doing is that it highlights the potential that some of this has really been happening. As to actually what's ultimately involved, I don't know. But certainly this investigation of this, what I refer to as an alien DNA paradigm, it suggests that whatever they're doing, they seem to have been doing it for quite some time, not only in terms of modern Western culture, with what we see and understand as the alien abduction phenomenon, but it also seems to be happening in historical times and also back thousands of years, which puts it into a whole new ball game, particularly if it's, you know, evidence of this might be confirmable courtesy of DNA through indigenous cultures, that kind of thing. So to me, it's a very promising area of investigation that really needs to be examined.
You know. So essentially, it looks like it is happening, but we don't know why.
Well, again, you know, you probably sense that I'm being a little cautious here.
I don't know.
Ultimately, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, of course. Yeah. Brian on our wildcard line he's trucking through Ohio. Brian, be careful driving out there.
Hello there, George and Mr. Cooper. I was just curious on your hair samples and that kind of stuff. Would you be interested in getting another hair sample?
I would, but with the, I guess, the caveat or the precaution that any investigation that we get into, because of the time, the cost, and the resources that we have to apply to these sorts of investigations, we do a pretty extensive workup in terms of investigating the, I guess, the chain of evidence, the credibility of the story, the whole background to it. So we need to do that because so much depends on that in terms of establishing the bona fides of the sample.
Brian, what do you have?
It all depends on the condition and the minute, on how well it can be hidden. Because the information I have, I don't want everybody to know about it.
Well, you have a piece of something that could be analyzed, is that what you mean?
Yes.
And it was from an abduction or an encounter experience?
Yes, very much so. In fact, it's from a hybrid.
Well, that's something certainly we'd be clearly interested in looking at. But, you know, obviously we'd like to have some kind of dialogue and sort of work with you and sort of look into the story as much as we can.
Right,
Brian,
right.
You want to tell the story now or not?
I'd rather send it to him and have him look it over.
Yeah. Well, we have okay.
Go on from there.
Well, we have links to where you can contact Bill Chalker. You can also send it to me, and I can send it on to him. I'd like to be in that loop too. That sounds pretty intriguing. Is that okay with you?
Cool.
Why don't you send us an email? Send it as soon as you pull over the truck and get to a computer, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. Thanks, Brian. We're going to take a break right now. We'll come back with more of your questions for Bill Chalker here on Coast to Coast AM. Back to the phones with your questions for Bill Chalker, east of the Rockies, Sam in New York. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, gentlemen. I had a question, and I'll take the answer off air. Have you ever heard of like the Aborigines having any experiences with aliens and stuff like that in Australia?
I have worked with a lot of Aborigine communities I've even had a couple of Aboriginal shaman type people even ask me to write their biography. And, you know, yes, and the short answer is that, yes, they've had a lot of experiences with UFOs, with what appear to be alien beings, et cetera. I wouldn't do the disservice with Australian Aborigines to argue that all of their sky being lore is due to aliens in the classic alien abduction tradition. But certainly when, if you recollect the 2000 Olympics here in Sydney, one of the big features of the opening ceremony was the big one genotype face that rose up out of the middle of the Homebush Arena, which was quite spectacular. That was the face of the primary Wanjina being, and that Wanjina being, for many people, and even prior to this, had Aboriginal people and also Western abductee type people remark on how close the Wanjina face appears and appears to be consistent with the classic grey alien being. You've got your two large eyes and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of aspects to Aboriginal experience here in Australia that seem to intersect with the whole UFO alien abduction tradition.
And is this long-term, way, way back? I know it seems I've seen sort of cave drawings or rock paintings that from Aboriginal people that go way, way back.
Yeah, well, the further you go back, of course, the more and more uncertain these sort of similarities become, and you start to speculate pretty wildly. You get into kind of Von Däniken speculation territory, but it's happening even now amongst remote Aboriginal communities, where I've even had communications with anthropologists who have worked for a decade or two amongst remote Aboriginal communities, where UFO sightings and abduction experiences have been quite common.
And have you looked at their DNA?
We're working on it.
I didn't mean to spill any secrets there. West of the Rockies, Mark here in Las Vegas. How you doing, Mark?
Hi, George. I had a question for Bill Chalker. I was watching those tapes of the Mexico City UFO sightings.
Yep.
And it does kind of look like Venus, except there's a formation of military helicopters, and then one of them passes between the cider and the helicopters. Did you see that?
Well, it's been about, it's been a long time since I've gone down that path and looked at all that information about particularly the Mexico eclipse videos. And I know that there are literally hundreds of videos that have come out of Mexico, and a lot of them associated with Mexico City and the eclipse, et cetera. And I don't particularly recollect that aspect, but of what I did look at the time, they all seem to involve this singular light source, et cetera, and the directions all seem to be consistent with the locations of where Venus should be.
So your statement, Bill, would be that of the ones you've seen, it seems that the explanation you give sort of covers it, but you're not familiar with all of them.
No, I'm clearly not familiar with all of them, and I don't know whether that film that's been described occurred on the day of the eclipse.
Mark, you still there? Mark's gone. First-time caller. Oh, Mark, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you want to follow that up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I was in agreement with him until I saw that one, and they actually slow the tape down there, and they kind of make a circle around the light source, and it does indeed pass in front of a helicopter. So then I thought, no, that can't be a planet.
Right.
Well, but there are hundreds of hours of those tapes. It's a lot to watch.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm only going on what information I had at the time, and I'd be certainly open to other inquiries and other information that might argue an alternate explanation for it. But based on what I looked at the time, it certainly compelled me to the idea that a lot of the videoing that occurred that day appeared to be of Venus, and they are amongst the videos that were being presented as of a UFO over Mexico City on that day.
I think your Hair of the Alien evidence is fantastic. You've done some really good work there.
Well, I hope it continues, because that's only all based on one single case. We've tried this approach to a good number of cases since then, and only a handful have got sort of marginally compelling evidence, and the Peter Currie case seems to be the one that's the most compelling to date, and it's certainly given us the most insights to date, all of which is really still in hypothesis territory, but we're looking at it, and it certainly suggested a lot of interesting avenues of research.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. So you get calls and people give you samples of stuff and you test it or investigate it, and it turns out to be pretty prosaic or mundane?
Yeah. Well, as I suggested earlier, there, because of the time, effort, resources, and money and that kind of thing involved, we really need to do a lot of extensive workup before we even get to the stage of going down that research path, because there's so much involved in doing it. And we need to be fairly certain about the authenticity of the sample, the the chain of evidence. And one of the issues you have to cover in a lot of detail and with a lot of care is the element of contamination. What has been the journey that sample has undertaken? Has it been handled by one, two, hundreds of people or whatever? Or how has it been preserved? So there's a lot of issues involved. And obviously, if it's been handled by a lot of people, et cetera, it becomes a very difficult and problematical sample.
Sure, you got to do a lot of work before you're willing to pay $10,000 a pop for the DNA test, I guess. Yeah,
it's not going to cost that kind of money these days. The techniques, in the whole field of DNA research, has increased exponentially. And if we had the same journey to undertake now, that we could do it now rather than back then, we may have done it a little differently because of so much improvement has occurred in DNA techniques since then, and we're only talking a few years, basically. And so the whole game is evolving and improving at an exponential rate. And so the opportunities are there. And I'm just arguing that a lot of these kind of abduction cases should be looked at in that light. And if there is biological evidence, it should be looked at using DNA techniques, that kind of thing. And that's something that I think American research should be doing. It shouldn't just be us here in Australia doing it as well.
Well, it raises the interesting question of whether or not the improved techniques would have a different result for your hair sample.
Well, that's true, and we have, as I said earlier, I qualified it earlier, we were dealing with a compromised sample at the time, but I think we got a pretty good result out of the limited sample that we had, and modern techniques might give us, I think, given the fact that we did replicate the results in the phase two tests, I think it would have confirmed the same sort of results, but we might be able to look at a lot of different areas. There are techniques now with DNA testing where we can do almost close to whole genome type testing or very large profiles of the DNA, all in very rapid sort of shotgun approach DNA type work. And so the techniques are becoming more and more sophisticated. But at the same time, because you can do more with a lot less sample, the complexities and problems with contamination become bigger and bigger. So there are a lot of issues involved in doing this work, and that's why we have to do it very, very carefully.
So could you take a hair sample and analyze it and recreate sort of a version of what the being looked like?
We're a long way from that.
Just wishful thinking.
Yeah, we have the same issue here where we're trying to clone the Tasmanian tiger here. We have various stuffed samples here and bits of hair and bits of skin, et cetera, but a lot of it's deteriorated and been preserved in the traditional ways, and so the DNA has been ultimately compromised in large ways. And the only way that you can do that kind of idea that you're suggesting is to put it all into a host animal, something fairly close, so you won't end up with an original Tasmanian tiger. You'll end up with something that's a bit of a hybrid.
Well, I'd love to see an alien hybrid that's blonde. And
so would I.
We're going to go to the first-time caller line, Phil in Newport Beach. Phil, we don't have a lot of time before the break. You can ask your question, and if need be, we'll come back. Phil,
no
you there?
No worries. Yeah, hey,
okay.
Guys. Hey, George. Hey, Bill. I'm moving to New Zealand here in Halloween, but don't worry, I know Aussies are tougher than Kiwis.
Okay.
But anyway, let me think, where do I start? Oh, wow. The whole contact experience changed my life, my dad's life. And in a way, the whole human race is kind of a hybrid experiment, if I do say so. And how do you think about how the whole contact experience happens, how it's either physical or it's...
Hey, Phil, you got to turn something down there in the background. You're bleeding in some audio to us, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it too much? Okay. Let me move outside. I was thinking about what is it, how they possibly, when they're not ready for the experience, they separate the consciousness from the so-called animal body, so the panic doesn't come in.
Phil, Bill, have you heard of cases like that?
Yeah, of course. There are a lot of cases where there is that kind of trauma aspect to it. There's a kind of a blocking off or a separation process goes on. You know, obviously, I'm more comfortable in areas that do with the physical aspects of it, but I work with a lot of people that deal with that kind of aspect where you're getting into the more consciousness aspects of it. And and I guess if you want to go the whole gamut of it, there are people that are working in what they refer to as multi-dimensional kind of aspects, you know, some of which falls and spills into what's popularly referred to as the New Age aspects. Those, to me, are a little less compelling and a lot more subjective than, you know, the physical approach, but there are aspects that may have validity and need to be looked at, and a lot of people are looking at that aspect.
Phil, you can continue, but we're going to take a break. Hang on, and we'll get back to your follow-up question after the break. Stay with us. We're into the home run stretch here with our guest, Bill Chalker, and we'll get back to more of your questions after the break on Coast to Coast AM. We go back to the phones. Phil in Newport Beach, take it away.
Hey, guys. Great music tonight, George. Anyway, I'll let you go after a couple things. About the separating the consciousness from the body and how they're not ready for the contact. But from the earlier caller with the Aborigines and their legend of the, I heard there was a legend of the reptilian race that lives underground that rules over men. And the other thing is, if you could help any other contactees out there and how to deal with what they're experiencing and going through the transformational process with love and everything. Love you guys. Thank you. Meditate, everybody.
Thanks, Phil. Good question, though. What advice do you give to people going through this experience, Bill?
It's a kind of pretty complex sort of situation because, number one, really, you've got to look after the welfare of the people involved, et cetera, and if there's any kind of conflict between, I guess, the detailed kind of research investigation side of it and the welfare of the people involved, well, then, you know, the research investigation side of it takes a back seat and just stops. You know, you've got to really sort that side of it out. And some people who try to explore this have got so much conflicted baggage that it's best for them to sort of stand back and sort out their own lives first, you know, with the appropriate assistance before they start exploring this very complex and confronting area.
Is there such a thing as warding this off? I've heard these cases here in America in particular where people can make it go away.
Well, I know that Dan Droffel, who is a fairly experienced researcher, published a book on that very theme of trying to prevent alien abduction experiences, and I know there's a lot of mixed results in that area, and I get a lot of conflicting information from a lot of the people that I've worked with over the decades, and some say these things work, some say they don't, and some argue that it's going to happen, and there's not much you can do about it. That seems pretty pessimistic, but it seems to occur in a lot of cases, but others have tried some of the things that have been described by people like Androffel, and it seems to have worked.
In so many of the cases that we've heard documented by David Jacobs and John Mack and Bud Hopkins, it seems to follow families generation to generation. Any indication that Mr. Corey's family had any other experiences earlier?
Well, he had experiences as a child, and there are, well, it's kind of a personal thing that in his case I don't want to particularly get into.
Okay.
I don't think he'd enjoy me sort of exploring that aspect, because we have had a lot of discussions along those lines. But I know that one of the classic cases that I looked at from New Zealand in an area called Gisborne on the east coast, there was a very complex milieu of abduction cases that occurred with many different people in the Gisborne area back in 1977 to 1978, and some of it's ongoing, and it does seem to be generational in the sense that in one classic case there, one of the best cases there that I've looked at, the daughter of the main person who featured in the 1977 cases her daughter's having experiences, and it seems her own children, the grandchild of the original abductee, is having experiences, and that's something that's being played out here in Australia and with that family. So it's something that I've been looking into and following.
And it's a really disturbing aspect of the whole thing, for sure. Wildcard Line, Kevin in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, George. How you doing?
Okay.
Out in the field out now, my backyard, right near where Flight 931's down. Yeah, playing out here in a crop circles. You know what crop circles?
We know about that, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a crop circle out here about the size of a football stadium right now.
What shape?
People walking around down there and looking at things.
And so tell us.
I just picked up three coins down there. One of them says pachinko on it. And it's got a picture of a crop circle, and I'm standing with the rest of them now. You can see the gentleman wants to talk to you.
I'm not sure I understand this. You're telling me that in the middle of the night people are walking around in a crop circle near where you are?
Yeah, right in Pennsylvania where Flight 93 went down.
And when did this appear?
There's an object there with blinking, flashing green lights on it.
Really? When did it appear?
It's still sitting there. I'm right down next to it, about 5 feet from it.
Well, I don't know if it's actually happening there.
This guy wants to talk to you, I think. Here, Kelly, ask him what you want to tell him. I want to know if there are no Atlanticus Tanaticus. He's got a coin I gave to George Norris. I mailed it to him myself with a UFO myself. Yes, yes, yes. I understand you. Yes.
Hey, Kevin, thanks. That was very interesting. I don't know where he was going. Bill, what were you going to say about that?
Well, I'm just saying if there was any substance to that story, or really the nature of the story he was implying, you know, I know I have a lot of experience in investigating UFO landing cases where there's been physical traces, and one of the best researchers in that area operates out of the United States, and that's Ted Phillips, and he's looked at literally thousands of those sorts of cases. So if there's anything to these sorts of stories, he's the man to look at them in terms of the U.S. experience anyway.
Ted Phillips is one of my favorite guests. We've had him a couple of times here, a very experienced and credible researcher.
Yep.
I know you've had some similar formations in your part of the world. Used to be called saucer nests, right?
Yeah, well, the saucer nest name came from the classic case from 1966 at Tully, which I've looked at extensively over the years. And it was even the inspiration for either Doug or Dave, whichever one, who was actually living in Australia at the time. That inspired him to go faking a lot of the crop circles that occurred in England. I'm not saying that he was the sole perpetrator or source behind every crop circle that's occurred, but the original 1966 Tully nest was certainly a very classic example of the unexplained sort of landing sites where a large circular area about 30 feet across was discovered directly in the wake of a UFO rising out of a lagoon area, which was had all sorts of reeds in it, etc. And it became a media sensation in the day, and the name crop circles arose from that.
Well, Doug and Dave may have been remarkable old barflies, but I don't think they're responsible for all the crop circles that occurred in even their own neck of the woods.
Yeah.
East of the Rockies, Chris in Houston. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. My question is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. In my personal experience and my encounters, I have seen, and what I've seen and what I've been told leads me to believe that some of the hybridization has been between humans and other animal species, so specifically feline, cetacean, and avian. In other words, not only are some of the entities or people that are in these what we consider aliens actually combinations of human and feline or cetacean or avian, but that also they've introduced into some of us selected bits of DNA, genetic material from these other species, specifically for experimental medical to improve, et cetera. Have you come across anecdotal or physical evidence of anything like that?
I haven't specifically, but when you think about what we're doing, we've
different species and splicing off pieces of DNA from different species and or even from plants and cross splicing and that kind of thing. We're doing it, so if it's in fact what's happening amongst alien abduction cases, it wouldn't surprise me.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah,
first-time caller, Ann in Florida. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I had an interesting experience when I was a child. I was traveling with my mother, and we'd been picked up from the airport someplace in Arkansas, and we were driving on the road. It was a two-lane highway through cornfields, and the guy driving was a member of an auxiliary fire department or something, so he had a two-way radio. And in the distance, we saw this bright light coming through the cornfield, and he braked because he thought it was a tractor or another car coming through the cornfield. And we waited and waited. And when it finally got there, it was very, very bright, moving very, very fast, you know, maybe 6-7 feet off of the ground. And, like, you know, like whoosh, just went past. And I remember staring there for a while. And then he tried starting the car. The car had stalled and or it had just died. And we tried using the radio, and the radio was nothing but static. And when we got back to the house with the people we were visiting, we got back to his house, his wife said, why didn't he answer the radio? And that there had been 2 hours time lapse. He should have been back 2 hours ago. 2 hours, you know, had gone by. And, you know, we didn't remember sitting there for 2 hours or anything.
That sounds like an interesting story to explore. Have you talked to any kind of experienced researchers in the States or near where you live?
No, I haven't. This was in Arkansas, and I really didn't even think it was. I remember he called in the morning. He called some places, and he had friends, I guess, in the military or some kind of base maybe. I don't know where it would be. I was just a kid, you know. It was in probably 66, 67.
Even though it occurred a long time ago, I'm sure between George and myself, there'd be people that we could put you in touch with that would certainly like to find out about
Well, they told him, the military told him that it was a meteor. And I'm thinking, if it was a meteor, how come it didn't catch the corn, which was dry, on fire?
Yeah, it's a pretty low-flying meteor.
I don't know. The more I've heard about meteors and stuff, I'm thinking, why didn't it scorch the car or scorch the ground? And why didn't we feel heat from it? Why didn't it set the cornfield on fire? And how come it was like, you know, 6-7 even feet, like, off the ground?
Well, I think if it was a true meteorite event, the effects would have been a lot more catastrophic. So I doubt that explanation based on what you're saying. But it sounds like a experience that would be well worth looking into, and encourage you to get in contact with it, either George or myself or some of the local UFO researchers.
And you are welcome to send us an email or something with some contact information, and we'll see what we can do about hooking you up, okay? Thanks. Bill, I wanted to mention, I remember when I was down there in your country, hearing some high strangeness cases, and I mentioned in the tease sort of about Mothman-type activity, and remember hearing stories sort of similar to Skinwalker Ranch, the Utah Bigelow Ranch. You've looked into some of these, haven't you?
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting ones for me, and it's an area that I like to specialize in at times as well, is the historical pre-1947 cases. And there was a case I looked into, and it was a story I got from one of the original participants who was 10 years old at the time, and his sister, who was living on a remote property up near Moolumbar on the New South Wales-Queensland border. And back in 1927, their family ran a kind of a dairy farm type thing with some pigs, et cetera, and that kind of thing as well, and dairy cattle. And for a period of several weeks, they experienced a phenomena that was remarkably prophetic of what was to come in the Ohio Valley during 1966-67 with the Mothman prophecy stuff that was popularized by John Keel. And it had back in 1927 here in Australia, on this remote property, you had the whole gamut of lights in the sky, UFO landing, a mark left behind, what appeared to be men in black, strange bird-like creatures that terrorized a number of the people in the area, and cattle and pig mutilations going on, all this happening in a very confined period of time way back in 1927.
And what do you make of that?
always different.
Come on, you're on the spot. What does it all mean?
Well, it certainly seems that something very strange is going on, and it appeared to be quite alien in nature, and that whatever was involved appeared to be UFO-related and seemed to be interested in our livestock and also the people.
Looking at the bigger picture, when you look at these high strangeness cases, UFOs, mutilations, crop formations, even sometimes poltergeist-type activity, does it all fit together? Is it telling us something?
You know, because it's so high strangeness and they're in the minority, it shouldn't necessarily be the thing that guides us in the way we try to understand the UFO phenomenon. But clearly, it often is at the cutting edge. You know, I know when you mentioned poltergeist, I'd been sort of pondering that recently, particularly with the passing of John Keel, because that was one of the things that he liked to get into. One of the classic cases of a car stop case where a UFO hovered over a car and shone a sort of a transparent beam down onto the car and stopped the car. It occurred at a place in Western Australia in 1967, a place called Booyah Brook in Western Australia. And that location was not only the location of a lot of UFO phenomena, it was the location of a classic poltergeist outbreak, one that occurred way back in 1957, and the area was virtually exactly the same. And even at the time, back in 1957, there was UFO phenomena associated with the classic poltergeist outbreak. And this was of the form of falling stones that would drop out of the sky, and it became a major media event. So there is that kind of connection going on. Just what all it means, I don't know, but there's certainly very weird, high strangeness aspects to this whole subject that we've got to get a real grip on.
Well, tell me, are you uncomfortable or do you stop yourself from even speculating, or at least in public, about the ultimate answers? Are these aliens from other planets? Are they dimensional beings, travelers in time, things of that sort?
I'm never too afraid to speculate, but I always realize that speculation might be repudiated within a week because of the nature of the events that you keep investigating. But to me, the whole UFO phenomenon seems to involve something that appears to exploit a technology that's way beyond us, but it also seems to interact with us at levels that, at least from our point of view, appear to go into the whole strange, high strangeness aspect, the paranormal aspect, the consciousness aspect. They're all valid aspects of the UFO phenomenon, and we've got to be able to be consider all those aspects to come up with a valid answer to the UFO phenomenon. And all our speculations to date have, I think, fallen short. The UFO phenomenon, at the heart of it, seems to be something that's a lot stranger than just ordinary nuts and bolts extraterrestrial explorers. That appears to be part of it, but something else is involved, or that seems to involve things that at a very complex level that go way beyond your average garden variety ET traveler.
Well, not just complex, but nonsensical, things that don't seem to make sense on any level. It's almost like a learning curve, like it just wants to get us out of our thinking patterns, our paradigm.
Yeah, well, the Skinwalker Ranch saga became a little bit more public, etc. I'd already been aware of a lot of the aspects of it, and particularly in the earlier days when I went back into the 60s and 70s with Salisbury book, the Utah UFO display, all of which was the same area, and your own book. It was like a sense of deja vu to me because I'd been involved with areas like that in Australia where things were played out. Particularly in the 70s, while I was at the University of New England up at Armidale, where we had an area where high strangeness seemed to be the rule of the day. And we were there going down to these locations every weekend, and I spent weeks at a time in the area, and it wasn't just UFOs. It was landings, it was sort of psychic events going on, and some pretty weird phenomena all wrapped up in the same package. And it was difficult to find out what was going on then, and you've obviously had the same problems with the Skinwalker situation as well.
Well, see, Bill, after you write that Chinese UFO book, you can write that one. thanks for being with us. I really can't wait to get back down there and see you sometime.
Okay, it'd be my pleasure.
All right, Bill Chalker. Thanks. Bill Chalker was our guest. Thank you. Thanks also to T.D. Barnes, who was in the first hour. Jason, Gina, Ann, George, Ian, Art. Thank you all.